All right.
We're doing the intro here.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
All right. Okay, you guys. This is episode 4?
Yeah.
Episode 4 of Get Realism's podcast. Season 2, Shelter in Place. I am Adam Chase Wren.
And I am Christine Chen. Woo!
Woo, you guys. We're doing it live again.
We're going live.
We're doing it live. All right, so last week we talked a lot about writing. And,
yes, a lot.
We could dive more into that if you want, or if you want to just move on to, because I want to know the writing process on all of your shorts.
Sure. Let's just do whatever you want to. This is our own podcast. We say whatever the F we want.
We talked about Bird's Nest. We talked about Shakespeare on the Range. We haven't discussed what inspired you to do Yaoi.
Okay.
That's the one thing I highlighted that we haven't talked about.
Which is cool. I was on a podcast with my other friend. I have other friends, FYI.
Yeah, we know that you're famous. It's a privilege to be on a podcast.
Whatever.
I get it.
I was really surprised. He's like his name is Rob, and he is like a gamer type dude, and I didn't expect that his favorite short was Yaoi, actually. Mm-hmm. He was really moved by it. I was like, really? Wow. So I guess I expect him to like, I don't know, The Earth Below or something that was a bit more like geeky feeling, but no, he loved Yaoi. So Yaoi started in 2016, New Year's Eve. Mm-hmm. I was out partying with Diana Rose and her friends.
Yeah.
And I just suddenly had an idea, and I was like, hey, by the way, I think you have a lot of feedback.
Am I?
Yeah. Turn down whatever, the phone or whatever.
Is that better?
Oh, yeah. Much better.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So while we were, it was about to hit midnight, I just asked her out of the blue, hey, Diana, do you speak Arabic fluently? And she was like, yeah. I'm like, great. I'm going to write something for you.
Yeah.
And I think I was inspired first because that was during the time when Syrian refugee crisis was going on. That was really big and everybody was talking about it. And it still is a huge problem, but that was when it was at the height of it, I think. And I had always known that I wanted to tell a story, an immigration story of some sort, in honor of my parents who immigrated from Taiwan here to the U.S. They were not refugees. My dad came to study, and so he got his master's and his PhD in the States. And what always touched me was the fact that, I mean, they came not knowing the language very well. And that's mind-blowing. That's like as if I went to Brazil or some Spanish-speaking country and just studied my master's and PhD there. Like, I know the language well enough.
Yeah.
But, like, I just, it's freaking mind-blowing to me that, like, they did that. And I really wanted to honor that because I think immigrants are incredible and they're everything when it comes to work ethic and perseverance and just true grit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had here and there has told me stories about their experience coming to the US. And one of them really stemmed from the ending. And so my parents, when they were here, they were very poor, and they basically had to, it was very difficult to afford me as a kid. And the school that my parents, I believe it was OU at that time, some of the church people, like organization, student organization, got together and had a baby drive, essentially, and donated a bunch of baby goods to my parents so that it would be easier to have me and support me, you know, as a kid.
Wow.
And I just thought that was incredible, the story, the idea of forming these family away from families, you know, family away from home type thing. And that there's that polar extreme of awesomeness. And then there's the obvious stuff we're seeing in the news right now, which is all the blatant racism and whatnot. And another story that I took was my dad said that when he was, I believe it was NYU, but I don't know. He was at some school and I think interviewing to get in. And it was a Korean professor that basically told my dad that he shouldn't apply because there was no way he was going to be able to afford getting in, basically. But he was like super racist about it. And which reminded me that, you know, racism isn't just obviously whites against everybody else.
It's everyone against everyone.
Yeah, it's everyone against everybody else. And I wanted to make sure that was in the film. So that little part was put in with
that was very important.
Louisiana governor. So Bobby Jindal is I believe Pakistani or Indian, and he was very highly against Syrian refugees coming to Louisiana. And I just thought that was like mind blowing. And so it started from that. So those little tiny bits, and I just started writing with the idea of what is it like to create a family away from home, and then substituting it into the context of the Syrian refugee crisis. And so I did a lot of research. So when I research it,
but you also put in your own experience too.
Yeah. So when I research, it consists a lot of, I read a lot of news articles.
Yeah.
So NPR was, I read a lot of stuff right there, New York Times. And there was plenty of material at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched whatever documentaries were available to try to learn. And when I could, I would try to, I really like interviewing like real people.
Yeah.
Because nothing can beat that authenticity because it's real. And so I coincidentally, Diana is part Syrian. I had no clue. Like, I had already cast her. And then she was like, oh
really?
Yes. Like, I'm part Syrian.
In pre-production, like, that's when you found out.
Yeah, I was like, oh, shit. Wow. That's so coincidental. So her dad actually read the script and gave us major notes on it because in the beginning, the mentor in the story was actually a male when it started off, and it morphed into a female because he brought up that a traditional Muslim woman wouldn't feel comfortable being alone with a stranger man, basically. And it made a lot of sense, and it actually worked much better because we really dug into motherhood and the bonding of women together, you know. And so that served as a really nice thread all the way to the end of the story. So that's how the writing process started, just research and personal experiences hidden into the modern context. So
that's interesting because it's a story that is very, very grounded in reality. And that is, you know, literally for a reason. But it shed some light in terms of what you just talked about, and like racism is not, you know, just one thing or another. It's everything. It's all sorts of things, and it's a real thing that still occurs to this day.
Oh God! I mean, look at the news right now. It's insane.
The current events in our world right now is very, I mean, it just proves the point of Ya'albi tenfold.
Yeah. You know, I think what is interesting is it's always been there, but I think I saw a quote from Will Smith, and it was that it's not that it's getting worse. It's the fact that people are able to record it and show the world that it does exist.
Mm-hmm. That's, so there's now more proof that there are pieces of shit out there.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think a lot of it,
for lack of a better term,
people were just kind of suffering in silence without having a way to show that this is real. You know, this is a day-to-day basis for African Americans and a lot of people. So,
For a lot of heritages, you know, like there's, I mean, it kind of goes straight across the board at that sense, you know.
It's fear. People, there's just a lot of fear right now.
Without a doubt, there's so many people who, you know, experience this, probably not on a daily basis, but probably enough to understand that, oh, because you and I are different, this is how it is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a culture shock for a lot of people. Like, even in a very liberal city that I grew up in Oakland, there's still a lot of that. You know, it doesn't matter who you are. It's just there's always going to be some sort of oversimplification for you.
Yeah.
And it's not fair. It's, you know, but that's just kind of the way the world is. It embarrasses each other and, you know, holds each other accountable for stupid shit, you know, and we always fight it, but
yeah,
you know.
I think the issue is that it's so easy to live in a bubble, right? You can't fault people for being in that environment where they are in a bubble and they may not have access to certain kinds of education, or their network is highly influenced by people with certain beliefs. And I think that's what the beauty of filmmaking is that you're able to hopefully take a subject matter that is extremely threatening to somebody, but put it in a context that anybody can relate to, hopefully. That was kind of my goal with Yalvi. It wasn't to like convert people or really anything. It was to show a humanistic aspect of someone's life being affected by the environment around them. And I think that's what's great about, and the power of filmmaking is that you can do that. You can take, I mean, even like Zootopia. Zootopia is a prime example. It there's so many things in there that is about, you know, racism and about how the world is, but it's in this non-threatening little cartoon figures, and people are open to watching that. Yeah, people are more open to watching that, and then being suddenly sucked in and not realizing what they're actually, you know, watching, which is great. Mm-hmm. So,
well, speaking of Zootopia and things that inspire you, like, I mean, was there a movie that you've seen in your lifetime that sort of had that justification that you presented with Yalvi, where it's sort of like this moving message where you sort of just get it and you understand it, and it sort of shifted your perspective on how the world works? Like, have you seen a movie that sort of shifted your perspective?
I know I can touch on films that I know really affected me.
Mm-hmm.
Dead Poets Society was one of them.
Yeah.
And the reason why that touched me so much was I had been struggling so much with my relationship with my dad.
My dad too.
Yeah. And my parents are great parents. They're just very specific and very, they have very ingrained thoughts and beliefs, and they often clash with mine. And the character that I related so much with was the boy who wanted to be in theater, and his dad wouldn't allow him to do that. And in the end, he takes the crown and, you know, he commits suicide type thing. But the dad was so devastated by it. And you can tell that he really did love his son. He just didn't know what was best for him. And I think that opened my eyes, because it kind of helped me understand my dad a bit more.
Yeah.
To try to see a perspective like, all right, it's really hard because I'm in it right now. And like,
it's just another human being.
Yeah.
Understanding,
like, he's another
something
human
different.
Being and he loves me.
Yeah.
But may not be able to understand like what I need right now, but that doesn't mean he doesn't love me.
No, yeah.
Less, right? And so mm-hmm. I think that was something that really, really touched me. Those kinds of that particular movie, I just remember that being like, I really, really understood that, because I understood how that character felt of like, nothing you do is good enough. Everything that you want doesn't make sense to the other person and whatnot. So I think that was one of them.
Dead Poets Society is a wonderful movie.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah.
And the whole like mentor and student relationship and how important that is.
Yeah.
And because Robin Williams with his class and stuff, and how he's such a good influence, and I don't know. I just thought there was a lot of messages in there that I really related to. So that's the first film I can think of that really like stood out to me.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's a bunch that I can't.
Oh yeah, there's so many of those.
Yeah.
Those types of movies, but yeah, Dead Poets Society is definitely one of those movies that.
Hi, Orlando.
That gives you a lot of perspective on another human being, that just kind of shows the people who love you and treat you with kindness and careness, they have a different way of treating you with kindness and careness. You know,
yeah.
It's not the same as your kind of kindness and careness. Yeah. It's
Orlando, my DP friend is on the Instagram Live, so I'm just saying.
Oh, is it? Right on.
So I'm excited because I just recut my reel, my director's reel.
Right on.
And he shot two of the films in there. And it was really, I love, like, I never have enough time to do reels except now
because of
quarantine. And there's something about going through your old work and putting it together and just realizing, man, how many, I think when I put together my reel, I was like, man, I have so many cool people who like gave me their time to make all this stuff happen. Like, I was just so humbled from it. I felt really loved and just thankful, because like every one of those films took resources, took somebody who dedicated their time, who like took off their weekend, you know, or weeks or whatever, just to make this movie, whatever movie it was. And I just was very, very thankful to be surrounded by so many people who are so talented and so to help me out. So
it's crazy the amount of talent that I've got to work with. It's absolutely insane. Especially you bringing me on a project, even my very first one in Writer's Block. I mean, everyone has their stories about it, and you have so most certainly have your history with it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, for me, it was working with more talented people than I could ever be. You know what I mean?
Like, that's what you want, though. You want to surround yourself with people
absolutely
who are better than you, that
continue. And that's where it all clicked for me.
Yeah, you know?
It all was like, oh, this is it. Oh, okay.
And the crazy thing is, like, you never know where in your life you're going to cross again. That's why it's like so important to be nice to everybody and to treat everybody with, you know, respect, and no matter which position they are, because you don't know. Adam, you could very much be directing your next film, and you could all be our bosses, you know? I'm laughing right now, but 10 years from now, or five years from now, We'll see you about that. But like, I'm just like, or the reason that's why I mentioned that is because like I said, Orlando was on, and I don't know if you remember how I met Orlando.
You talk only briefly. I never knew how you met.
So this is why it's so cool. So I met Orlando through Craigslist.
Miss Connections.
So what happened was, I was a documentary filmmaker at that time. And after I graduated from Rice, I didn't have access to cameras anymore.
Yeah.
Because I've been using Rice's cameras. And I'm like, oh, crap. Like, I want to keep making films. If I'm going to keep making films, I'm going to need my own equipment. And I looked on Craigslist, and Orlando was selling a little mini HD camera using the little CD discs and stuff. Yes. And I actually ended up not buying it from him because it was a, I had read that CD discs were going to go. And he was very honest. And he was like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And we kind of chatted. And kept in touch. And when I needed to make my next project, I realized I didn't know any DPs, but I knew that guy from Craigslist that was really nice to me and said he was a DP. So mm-hmm. I emailed him back and I was like, hey dude, I know we only like exchanged emails and stuff, but would you want to DP my project?
And was it a fast turnaround? Did he say yes or?
Yeah, he read it. We met.
That's crazy.
We've been friends since, and he DP'd
Gloria, not your ordinary hero.
That's crazy. Okay, so you sort of.
I'm still getting feedback, man. Did you mute me?
No, but you were breaking up on the face. You were breaking up on the Zoom meeting.
Okay.
For those of you who didn't catch that, she was talking about her friend Orlando. They worked together for the past 10 years. And they you still love to work with him.
Like, yeah, and we met on Craigslist. That's so.
And they met on Craigslist, yeah.
So I always call him my Craigslist buddy.
The Craigslist buddy.
Yeah. So
are you still getting feedback?
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah. Are you?
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hearing myself.
Hang on.
I'm hearing myself talk, and it's kind of nice.
Maybe I'll do that.
Yes. Hello, Drew. Hello. It's just crazy like who you might meet and who
is there still feedback
to, no yeah we're good right now who's going to keep staying in your life and you know working with you and stuff like that, so
yeah.
That's, you know, you just have to meet people and be friends, and this is a good transition to one of our questions, which is Calvin O'Neill
shout out.
How have you found crew members for all of your shorts? So,
yeah,
I've gone through multiple different ways. I always feel like you got to give something a value first before you expect value from others, right? And so you can apply this to everything in life. So what I mean is jump on someone's set, give them value. Give them your time, and people are more willing to donate time to you. So I did that. I started working on other people's sets. My first set when I was in Austin was a student film. I volunteered to produce Alex Murphy's film. And from there, I met a bunch of people. And so when I was ready to make my next thing, those are the people that I reached out to. So that's one way. Give value, and then you'll easily get value back, you know, when you're needing help. So,
and you also work good together, you know?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Work, yeah.
And so then the second way I've gotten is, you know, the good old just putting it up on a board of some sort. So like there's, you know, Facebook groups now where you can ask for cast and crew. Craigslist was a thing. I don't know. Is Craigslist still a thing right now? Like,
It still is. It's that. Just, I've seen only like UT kids. Like,
yeah. So I haven't posted on that, but that used to be like the place to reach out to. So, but just publicly.
Facebook is better though.
Yeah. Publicly announce, hey, I need help. Blank. Anybody be willing to help me type thing. And you'd be surprised. Food goes a long way, so if you can just promise people food, sometimes you'll get a newbie who's willing to come help you out, basically. So that's the second way I've gotten crew, and just really word of mouth. The more, and it's always the first one that's the hardest. Everything subsequently gets easier because people learn that they love working with you, hopefully, and they want to continue working with you, and so then it's easier to communicate and ask those people who they would recommend for your future projects. So then it becomes word of mouth after that. Yeah. So I would say these three ways.
And those connections branch out even farther.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So if I were to summarize, it would be first give value so that you can get value back.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one is just put your ask on in the publicly, you know, whether that's Craigslist, Facebook, Instagram, you know, some way get it out there that you need help. And the third one is word of mouth, from people that you trust. So that's how I've gotten, how I found crews for all my shorts. So good question, Calvin. Yes. So, so we kind of answered this. The question was from Mike Dimo or Demo. What's the next step after you've written a story that needs to be documented? Kind of.
Yeah.
So, let's say we've written a script. Usually what I do is I go through and do a breakdown of the script. I don't know if you haven't finished your script, so you haven't got
there. I haven't finished it.
So this might actually be helpful.
Yeah.
So this is essentially what the AD does, right? So I go through and I do a breakdown of the script. And essentially the breakdown is I go and highlight things that are like props, figure out what locations I have to go to, figure out how many characters I have, any weird makeup changes, stunts, vehicles, and stuff like that. So I make those, that breakdown. And if anybody who needs to do a breakdown, there's probably a much better explanation on YouTube. Just type in how to break down a script. The old school way is you take different colors and all. I don't even know.
Highlight them. Yeah.
I have no clue what the colors are anymore. You just kind of know.
I sort of been making my own colors.
So. Yeah, exactly. Just do your own thing.
Okay.
As long as you understand.
Yeah.
You can put it in the beginning. I lucked out when I was in school. I was savvy and used my academic, my student status a lot. I took advantage of that a lot. So when you're a student, you can get a lot of these programs for a significant discount. And so I invested in Movie Magic Scheduling because as a student, I think I got it for like dirt cheap. Now it would cost like five times as much, basically.
Right.
So I invested in a bunch of those programs. And so I started to learn Movie Magic by doing my breakdowns of my script. So that's the second process. And what I'm essentially trying to figure out is how many days can I conceivably shoot this film in?
Right.
And how many locations do I have to go find? How many crazy props do I have to buy? And that will end up translating into like a budget type thing. So this is important because it shows the feasibility of your script and whether or not maybe you might need to make changes to your script to make it more feasible and doable. That's why, like, I think as a writer, there's a power to writing with what you have. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, yes, you can write your sci-fi with a shit ton of VFX, but you're never going to get to make that, you know, soon. But if you're able to know, like, hey, right. I have my two friends' house, which, okay, I can kind of walk through. At Bird's Nest, we had Adam's parents' house.
Right.
So we wrote it for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yalby, we still had Adam's friend and family's house.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. So I don't know if you noticed, but Yalby and Bird's Nest are shot in the same place.
Oh, they were. Okay. I recognized it. It was the home in, that wasn't Louisiana, was it?
Yeah, it's Louisiana, the same place. Okay. Nobody can tell. Nobody knows because we like decorated it completely different.
Well, and also, you shot it differently. So
yeah, we shot it differently, and also it was technically two places fused into one.
So you could have easily got me fooled with two different houses.
Totally. We
separate locations.
Yes, and so so we wrote it because we knew we had access to that. And then we knew that we had access to churches and stuff like that. And then we kind of like did that with it. Six Words was also like that. We shot it with one location. We wrote it for one location. And that location was the producer and lead actress, Elizabeth's house. So, so the Earth Below was the one that we kind of went out of our comfort zone. Because that was a whole world that we had to build. It was a sci-fi world. but we were able to think creatively as to how we could make that work. And so the main location was actually an art gallery, which is not that hard to find. And then we found spots in Austin that looked futuristic looking and cheated the way we shot it. And then my friend let us borrow his high-rise apartment that kind of looked modern and just dressed it up and yay, movie magic. So everything that I've written has been within the confines of what I know of access to.
Yeah.
So that's, again, a complete tangent from the question of like, what do you do after you write a script? But these are the things I think about. I have to put on my producer hat and be like, how can I make this project feasible? And then after that, you know, you can go into casting. You can go into casting at any point, honestly. Sometimes, you know, I've already had people pre-casted before I wrote. You know, obviously, like, Yalby was one of them. Diana was already casted before I had even written the script. Bird's Nest was the same way. Deep Garner was already casted for the lead of David before I'd even written the script, because I'd seen their work before, and I knew that they could do it. And so if not, then you go through the casting process, and that's a whole thing. And how do you find casts? Exactly the same way that had how you get crew. Find people off other sets.
Who you know.
You go to film festivals and you see people's performances that you like, and you make connections. It's word of mouth, or you post it somewhere. It's pretty much similar. And so, and then there's like places like Actors Access, on Facebook groups. There's right now in Texas, if you're working in Texas, there's the Texas Casting and Crew group. There's a bunch of those. And so that's how I go about it, I guess. And then after I do that, then I figure out what can get donated. So who has what? Yeah. Who has what camera? Who can I borrow? Can I borrow first? And this is where you'll start to see a lot of funny Facebook status messages that I'll have. Be like, hey, anybody have a boat?
Somebody have a severed hand.
I think the weirdest one I had was, I think, who has dead cockroaches?
Oh, man.
Yeah. So that was for Not Your Ordinary Hero. We had body doubles. We had cockroach body doubles.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, yeah, but that was, people were like, oh my God, your status is. But yeah, this is for movies. So,
yeah.
And then I figure out, I reach out to local businesses and see if they might be able to donate food or anything helps out. Let's just say that. Anything to decrease the amount of cash that you don't have to put in. Because I am one of those people who hasn't been lucky in terms of money, but I've been blessed with people giving me in-kind donations. So everything that I've done has been on like $2,000 that I've saved from working all my jobs, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, no rich uncle or aunt or what, or parents or anything. It was all blood, sweat, and tears, everything. And then I was very resourceful when it comes to asking and partnering with people to get things donated. And I think what helped me is that I am also constantly shooting things that are corporate that I know are paid. So it's a good negotiation tool as well. Like, hey, could you do this one thing for me for free if I can guarantee you a paid job later, type thing. So being savvy about that. I'm also an AD on projects. So people know that most of the time those projects are going to need equipment or whatever they have. So maybe helping me out will allow.
And she means assistant directing, by the way. Yeah.
Sorry. Yes.
It's okay.
So. Yeah. So I'm able to use that and say, hey, for example, with Six Words, I knew we were going to rent my friend's camera on a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so throwing in 2 days over the weekend for free wasn't a big deal because they were going to get full rate for their camera for 2 weeks, you know? So it's just really being able to read people about like what they want. That's not necessarily monetary is a big thing. So, What else do I do after? That and then getting all the locations ready, all that stuff, and then getting ready to shoot. So it's kind of the process.
Pre-production. Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of pre-production.
Yeah.
So, yes.
More pre-production, the better. The more you're prepared for any shoot, I feel is setting up for success. You know, yes. Tiny little pre-production is no good. No bueno.
Yeah. So we've kind of answered, we've answered two of those questions. And we answer, what is the process when you write films? So we're still talking about that. DJ Windred asked that. So we can continue to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But since we're talking about production a little bit, I'm going to just answer one of these other questions, which was the Prestige _YT asks, what's the biggest mistake to avoid when filming? Okay. So
what's that big mistake?
Yeah. So what is the biggest mistake to avoid when filming? So I have the biggest one that I've learned is to not hire people based on what they have. Hire people because you don't mind spending lots of time with them.
You're good to work with. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Hire people based off of that. And it's okay if, honestly, it's okay if they're not like the most knowledgeable at their job, because they can learn, you know.
Anybody can learn.
I mean, granted, if it's like a crew head or something, you might want somebody who
some people have different temperaments. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, experience this way a little bit heavier. However, absolutely. In the end, like, you're gonna be stuck with these people for 15-hour days sometimes or longer, and it really needs to be someone that you can be okay to work with.
And so, usually you're working like double digit days, you know, like you're working days with that person.
Yeah. And you're definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely just work with people who you want to work with. I think that's really important. Before that, one of the first projects I ever did, I hired people because they own certain things. And I thought that was important because I didn't know people with a camera or whatnot. And the problem is, I hated everybody that was working with me. It didn't freaking matter that they had a camera. Like, they didn't listen to me and they didn't respect me as a director. And it was a terrible experience. So I will never do that again, ever, you know. And I will hire somebody who is enthusiastic and wants to learn over somebody who thinks they knows everything.
Because there's a huge difference when you don't have the passion for the thing you also want to do. So like, if this is a project that you're passionate about and that you want to do, but yet the other person who you hired, who is very talented at what they do, their heart is just not in it.
Yeah.
That's also feels like a red flag, right?
Yeah, definitely. That is totally a big red flag. So
yeah.
That's why I always tell, one of my big advices for, I get this question a lot, advice for young filmmakers is treat every gig like they're the same as the gig that you're getting paid hundreds of dollars, like thousands of dollars for, or the one that's free. Like, you have to treat them.
You treat it the same. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to treat it equally. They're both jobs. I think the problem when you get out of school is it's hard sometimes to remember that this isn't a class. Like, it's not like, oh, I'm just gonna skip class and it's gonna be fine. It's your reputation, and if you mess it up, people remember, and it sucks, because that's often why they say, like, don't take something until you know that you're ready for it, because you could really mess up future opportunities because people just remember you as a person who screwed up on their job versus somebody who was just really trying, just didn't know enough, you know? And so you have to take everything seriously because you're auditioning for your next job on that job, always. And it may not feel like it because it's definitely not always true that you'll get a job immediately from that job. It may be 5 years from there then before you get asked, but if you did a good job, I guarantee you at some point you will get asked back. because you were, if you were invaluable to that set, people remember that. I remember, I mean, like, Larissa and I talk about this all the time. Like, we can't help but get on set and, like, have a mental rating list in our head of our favorite PAs. Like, it just happens. Like, it's not, we don't do it on purpose. It just happens. It's because we remember the ones who made our jobs easier.
Mm-hmm.
You just do. Yeah.
So. Yeah, I do believe that your work ethic is reflective to your personality. You know, if you don't have a good work ethic, there's a good chance your personality is not one to work with. Or, you know, it's usually the people who are willing to. And there's also a fine line between like overworking and underworking, but there's a very nice little balance where you can easily do both. You can easily, you know, cater to one specific task, and then you fulfill it and you follow through with it. And following through is a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And when somebody doesn't follow through, that's a major, major reflection on who they are.
Yeah.
You know, like people just, you know, call out sick and they're just like, you know what, I can't do this. They quit. You know, it's.
We remember that. And it sucks because like sometimes it's not even that person's fault. Like I've had people pull out because they got a much bigger paid gig.
There's also that. Yeah.
I can't fault them for that. And, no. But you still remember that, you know?
They got mouths to feed. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know. So it sucks, but that happens. And
mm-hmm.
I think, just why commitment, you can't take that lightly at all because someone's counting on you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And it sucks when somebody doesn't follow through with that. But it's nice to work with the people who you know and you can trust, that you don't have to worry about shit like that. They'll definitely follow through. It's almost like there's an old movie quote, and I can't remember which movie it was, but it's just like, it's not about who you know, it's about who you can trust.
Yes, that's great. Yeah.
And the people who you know so many people, you know, so many people, but that doesn't mean that you're going to trust them for showing up for a 30-day shoot.
Right.
You know, and by the way, you're paying them minimum. And I mean minimum, you know.
Yeah, peanuts, yeah.
So it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, but you do it because they're, well, A, either your friend, or B, they are passionate.
They're passionate, and you've proven that they're reliable. Yeah.
Reliable, yeah.
Reliability is such a huge thing because you don't know. You could go to sleep, and tomorrow you may not have a caterer. You know, you don't want that.
If you want happy people, you're going to get some food.
Yes, exactly. So
any other there's questions?
One more question, but I can, I guess I can, I'll say it's the question is, the Travel Wins, asked, what is your dream project? And that one's right now. My dream project is En Route. Right now. I just want to make En Route right now.
Yeah.
That I'm putting all of my energy into the world to make En Route possible. For me, it's a very important story to tell. Especially right now with like first responders having their ass handed to them because they're like, everybody's out of quarantine and being stupid and they're like running ragged right now. Like my poor EMT buddies like will message me and complain to me so much and being like, oh my God, I didn't sleep the whole day. Or like there's trauma after trauma after trauma, or people are like on drugs right now because they're all like out and partying and stuff. And I just feel so bad. They're so stressed out of their minds, and people.
It sucks. Yeah.
And people don't. There's a thing right now. The reason why I feel like En Route is so important is because I personally was an EMT, and what currently is out there in terms of content is this heroic trope of what first responders are, that everything they do is like super high energy impact, and they're always saving lives, and like that's so heroic, and they can handle tough situations without any emotions. And it's not like that at all. And I want to show what happens when they've dropped off the patient at the hospital. and what happens the days, the weeks, the months, the years that happen after that, you know?
The recovery.
Trickle-down effect. Yeah. And so it has a lot to do with, you know, mental health. And people think, yes, we veterans definitely do, you know, experience PTSD, but a lot of people don't really think that, like EMTs do. You know, it's a different kind of PTSD. It's a cumulative effect. It's years of dealing and sucking it up and whatnot. So that's this is what I'm extremely passionate in. That's my dream project right now. I have other things on my, everybody has multiple projects on the horizon. And so for now, this one is my biggest one. If I can accomplish that, then I will tell you my next dream project after that. Yeah. I think we've answered all the questions. All right.
Cool.
So let's keep going.
Let's keep going. So we talked about, Albie. We haven't, so we did just graze the surface over six words. So you have, your parents are immigrants, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you, the writing process for six words, would you say was either easier or harder than the other things? Because what have you written before six words that was challenging to you?
Yalbi was the most challenging.
Yalbi, okay.
Yeah.
Because it's
for me was the most challenging before. And then A Bird's Nest and Two Roads weren't as challenging because A Bird's Nest was already kind of partially, it was a story already in existence that my friend had written and I adapted it to a screenplay.
Right.
So yeah, Eric Kwong,
who wrote
the story in high school. Two Roads wasn't that challenging because we were really doing it for entertainment purposes. So we weren't trying to like have a deep, deep message of some sort. And like, it was all fictional. So it was all whatever we wanted to make believe. And so that was like a fun, like, okay, this happens and this happened, this happened. Like, it wasn't that hard. Yalbi was difficult because it was a real situation. I wanted to handle it very carefully because I didn't want to wrongly represent a group of people just flippantly because I wasn't educated enough about their lives. So that one I did.
You didn't do your time and research.
Yeah. I did a lot of research and then a lot of rewrites and everything. So that was very, very difficult. Six words wasn't that hard for me to write. The intro, I basically just recapped how like my parents and I are and just wrote down what they would talk to me about, really. So it was, I had their voices in my head already. So it was just regurgitating it out. So that was fun. That was easy. The funny thing is I actually showed that film to my parents and they didn't get it. They didn't see themselves at all. In fact, they said it was like super exaggerated. And
No one will ever see themselves, even though it's a true depiction of who they really are.
They never
see it.
It's so funny. Inside of me, I was just like, Dad, you've literally said that line. Yeah, you literally, it's word for word, said that line.
Yeah, I mean, I know the script was probably easy for you to write, but it is somewhat emotionally complex though, because the main character is dealing with a really tough relationship with her parents.
So,
you know,
so that was inspired personally. So what that incident specifically was my parents and I. There was a period where when I was starting to date people, and they really hated who I was dating. Mm-hmm. And I know specifically who it was. And I hid it for a long time that I was dating. And this one horrible day in undergrad, they found out, and it was a whole thing. Like, it was terrible. Like, it sucks. So writing it was super cathartic because I kind of had to relive those emotions. But it was a whole showdown right in front of everybody at Rice University. So
Really?
I kind of, yeah, it was awful. I had parents who didn't know me who told me that I could stay at their house if I needed to. Yeah, it was very bad.
Wow.
Yeah. And yeah.
I have friends with parents like that. That's crazy. Yeah.
But what I did do was I envisioned if it hadn't happened that way. Because I knew what their intentions were. Like, now that I'm older and wiser, I understand their concerns and that it was all really, you know, for my good, you know, then it was out of love type thing.
It's their humanistic ways. Yeah.
Yes. So I just spun it in a way where if they had handled it in a different way,
mm-hmm.
in a more positive way, what that would have looked like. And then I injected another current situation, you know, and wrote it about that instead. So it wasn't a straight relationship, but it was, you know, their situation. So what was crazy was I had friends who went through that and were very, very touched by it. So I was like, oh, thank God. Because it's a universal feeling. If you boil down to it, it's the relationship between you and your parents, mm-hmm. and there's a disagreement by your beliefs, mm-hmm. and how do you reconcile the two but still honor your parents,
yeah,
without fully giving into their beliefs because you really believe in your own beliefs, right? How do you stand as an individual yet respect your parents? So
it takes a lot of courage. I mean, it takes a lot. Yeah.
And it's a big thing, I think, amongst, especially with Asian American families, because we grew up very much like respect your elders. And it's always about community and the greater good of the entire family unit. It's very, I would say, if there is a big difference between traditional Asian culture and traditional American culture, Americans really value independence. It's, you know, freedom of speech. It's your freedoms. Don't let people like take them. It's you, and how I am as an individual.
It's too many. You're so special. You're a very special boy. You're a very special.
No, it's not a bad thing. It's just different.
It's not. Yeah.
In the Asian culture, it's very much like, how can you make everybody happy? You know?
I see that. Yeah.
Compromise so that everybody can be happy, you know? So there's a lot, there's also negative with that, right? So I think that's why I was drawn to films, is because I for the longest time, never felt like I had a true voice, individual voice for a while, because I had to compromise my own voice for the greater good of everybody being happy, you know? And films was one way I didn't have to do that. I could say whatever I wanted. And Six Words is about that, being in a culture where you compromise, that you're supposed to compromise what you believe in for the greater good, and what happens when you can't. So it questions that, because I dealt with that really even now. Like that's just I've always felt this weird in between. I know, having watched a lot of other Asian American documentaries, a lot of Asian Americans feel this way. It's not being able to really belong in any culture, because we see the best of both worlds. So we're kind of in this middle, you know? And I think that's why a lot of my films have a very distinct character of somebody who is misunderstood. I love talking about...
Well, I was about to say, that's probably the best perspective you can get, is to split apart and understand both sides of everything, both sides of the world, and really, truly get... I'm not saying, like, you understand everything now.
No,
but it's fascinating to understand, like you said, when you got older, you just understood your parents and why they did what they did.
Yeah.
That at that moment in that time of your life,
right,
you agree to it, you didn't, you probably wanted them gone and out of your life, but in retrospect you sort of I mean, I don't know if forgiveness is the right word to say, but
Understanding, there's definitely understanding, and there is some. I think definitely, like, my relationship with my parents has continued to improve because I have that perspective, and right. I think the beauty of being a writer and a director is that you are forced to have that perspective to be able to write beefy roles that are not one dimensional, that that are controversial, that, you know, has depth. So I think that's been a very big benefit of being a writer director. So
yeah, and it's fascinating too, because I grew up watching movies, and I mean movies was my only escape, because it was, you know, there's a moment in my time where I felt like I was out of place, not only with my family, but with my school and everything. And movies was kind of the thing that was like, oh no, you are out of place, you are weird, but this is how great you're gonna be, or this is how great it is, you know. It's, and that's why, I mean, Star Wars was Star Wars sort of changed my perspective in a way that shaped and defied the reality that I'm in now, which is like, just be good to one another.
I think your phone died.
My phone didn't die, it just somehow stopped.
Oh, okay. Do you want to go back?
Oh, but it ended.
Yeah, it ended.
Okay, well.
We're almost done anyway.
Yeah, okay. Whatever. It definitely had that perspective for me where it was like, you know, the story of becoming from nothing and then becoming something, becoming that outcast, becoming that outlier in a bunch of people who are just wanting to just earn their 9-to-5 job and do what they possibly can.
Yeah.
And for me, film is, and writing, storytelling in general is so part of my DNA. I love telling a good story. I love writing a good story. And I like even experiencing good stories. That's what inspires me. Yes. And you create great stories, Christine. You know, your shorts. For sure. All of your shorts, even Fun Employment and En Route, I'm super excited for. You know, I'm excited to work on it, and I'm excited to see it. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that it's just like, if you share your passion for that one specific thing, whatever it is, I'm probably going to be invested in it as well. And that's why I love comic books so much. That's why I love movies. I love music, is because it's a very specific thing that someone is very passionate about, but they build something around it. They build the world in their own perspective and what their take is on it. You know, it's not like we're part of the rebels and we got to fight the Empire and destroy a Death Star. Like, that's not reality. And I know that, but at the same time, to defy that reality, to know that you are facing evil every single day. You're facing evil, you know, regardless, if you can see it. Sometimes there's evil that is invisible that you cannot even fucking see. And that's the scariest of all the evil. This whole COVID thing is a disguised evil. So that being said, I pull my influence for so many things because I grew up not subscribed to any religion. My mom is Christian. My dad was a Muslim. There was never a thing where I had to choose one thing or another. My parents were very, very agreeable when it comes to like, well, you can just discover your own way, because they also understand that religion is also a faith, and those faiths are founded upon these stories.
Yeah.
You know, and the stories of this monomyth, the hero's journey of, you know, coming from, you know, you are one person, then you become a whole different other person by the end. Like, that's the whole journey. That's the experience. And shifting your perspective can change your experience.
Yeah.
That's how I learned about life. What else is new?
Well,
it's just like the very few things that I learned, especially in this writing process. Writing is fucking... It's
cathartic, man.
Strange and difficult.
Yeah, difficult. It's hard.
Because I find myself watching more movies than I've ever did, even in my youth.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready. I'm definitely watching more movies than I've ever.
It's great because I remember the days where I only had about $10 in Blockbuster money, and I can only rent like 2 movies, or I had to share with my sister, and she was like, "Well, I want to watch this," and I'm like, "Well, fuck you, we watched that." You know? So yes. And now I have this instant access where I'm like, you know, I kind of want to watch like, you know, fucking Jurassic Park, and I can easily get that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's weird, it's strange, but I love it. I would never change it. But I'm watching more and more shit, and I'm soaking in all this knowledge now, and it's fascinating going back to writing, because like the very first page mm-hmm. of my script is it's a completely different Adam than on page 45.
Yeah.
Of the script.
Yeah.
It's weird because
you definitely grow with the script. That's
I was sure. much. I was an angry guy starting off this script. I started the script because I for some reason, like it was one of those things where I was like, not punishing myself, but I was telling myself like, you're not going to start this script. When are you going to start? You're just never going to do it. You're just never going to be a writer. That's just how it is. And then finally I'm like, fuck this. And I started off angry writing. Yeah. But I wrote a great action sequence out of that.
Ooh.
I wrote a fun action sequence. I wrote some fun dialogue.
At this point, I feel like you're making shit up because I haven't seen the script yet.
No, I know. Well, I could be making this shit up. I could be showing this to you, and you're like, I don't know what the fuck this guy is thinking.
Yeah,
this is a shit script.
No. I'm excited to read your scripts.
I'm just passionate for the things that I'm experiencing and the things that I'm talking about and writing about. Yeah. So this script is influenced by so many fucking things.
Yes.
And that's good. And I just, it's just a process of me trying to end this bitch and get a nice, good, tight script instead of long, dragged out fucking bullshit,
sure.
You know?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm excited.
But yeah, like you said, it could be complete garbage by the time you read it. And that could be the case. And that's fun. That's fun. It's all a learning process, you know? Yeah. Everything's a learning process.
It's 3 already.
Yeah, it is. So
I guess we can figure out maybe we could bring a guest or something next week. I don't know. Do you think you're getting tired talking to me?
Not really. I mean, I'm so far chilling. I'm writing stuff down. I always have shit to talk about. You know that.
Yeah.
I always have something to talk about. My brain doesn't stop. Mm-hmm.
Well, we can talk about it and see. Maybe we can bring somebody on.
We'll talk about it, but we'll end this episode. We don't have any other questions, right?
Nope. We finished all of them.
Okay, so I guess we can end this. I guess we can end this by taking away, what's your best experience on 6 words?
Oh.
Working on 6 words.
Well, I think...
See how good of an interviewer I am? I write this shit down, okay? Like this stoner.
I think the best experience I had with it is that we were able to accomplish something within very limited means. And so we had the idea.
There's only like 6 or 7 people in the crew, right?
Yeah, it was very small.
Yeah.
We made it for maybe $300, maybe. Because we didn't have, I was really broke at that time too. So, when Elizabeth approached me and said, "Hey, like, I want to make another film for the HBO Asian, contest," I think I was like, "Great," but I literally don't have means to fund anything right now. And so, we were able to still make it within those confines. And so, we made it because we could shoot it for 2 days. At her house, we got all the food donated, except like a few fillers. That's where the $300 went to. The equipment was rented because I had won with The Earth Below, coincidentally that she was in, at the Transform Film Festival, which gave us a gift card to the AMG, Awesome Movie Gear, which allowed us to rent perfectly, like with no extra, like perfect amount to rent the dolly for 2 days. So then we had that. The camera was donated because it wasn't really it was tacked on from another project because I was aiding on that project and could guarantee that my friend would be paid for that. And everything else was maybe like scrap paper for some, you know, decorations. So that's where maybe the other budget went into, but it was, that's how much the fact we achieved that story for
$300.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty well. And I remember watching it. I watched it again. I watched it with my mom and it's strange because right after I watched that, I watched a couple of other HBO shows and it shot like an HBO pilot. Mm. It shot like a really tight knit pilot. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of an interesting short. And I love the premise of it. And the,
yeah.
There's one scene where it's a party. It's a male genitalia party. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise because, I mean, can I spoil it or no? I should.
I guess so. I mean, you can a little bit. So it's
okay. Fine. Well, the parents show up. The parents show up and it kind of crashes the party in a way.
Yeah.
And from then on, it just sort of reminds me of like, you know, have you seen Insecure? The show Insecure?
Mm-mm.
Sort of reminds me of that. It's kind of like that awkward situation that you don't know how you can get yourself out of, you know, and it's kind of like an isolated incident.
Yeah.
I know I'm kind of overgeneralizing the show Insecure. It's much more than that. It's such mm-hmm. a fantastic show, such great writing. And it's written by one lady and she absolutely talented. And I forget her name and I'm blanking it out. But it's shot beautifully, and that would be, you know, DP Pierce.
DP Pierce also shot Do Better. Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Shout out to Do Better. Yeah. Shout mm-hmm. out to Six Words. Guys.
Yeah.
Genius.
No, that was. I definitely couldn't have made that.
So I guess my point was for how little you shot it for looked. Absolutely amazing. I mean, like Kevin Smith made Clerks look like an art house film. You know what I mean? Like, and he shot it because he couldn't afford a colored camera. He can only afford a black and white camera.
Exactly.
He's like, I didn't shoot it in an artsy way. I just can't afford.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So it's thinking outside of the box and thinking creatively, and that's how we made that work. And it's because of all the knowledge that has led up to that point that we were able to pull that off. Because we had already established, you know, a network of people that we trust, and we established people knew I put out good stuff, so they were more willing to commit time to help me out, or you know, if they knew it wouldn't be put to waste, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just it was really cool that we were able to make that for nothing, and how awesome it looks. And I don't know.
And it comes to proof that, you know, especially like something like even Earth Below, you know, like something that is a completely different genre. You shot it for how much?
Earth Below was a little bit more,
of course.
But it was probably like, I don't know, like 1500, but like people.
So there's no excuse to shoot a creative sci-fi fantasy movie that you can make within a small budget. There's
excuse. You just have
there's
to be
no excuse.
Creative about it.
Right,
you have to be very, very creative about it. But yeah, you can shoot. Some of the best stuff comes out of not being able to afford to toss money at something. You know,
that's how so many films work, like Clerks, Reservoir Dogs, El Mariachi.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think people are always surprised that my stuff costs so very little money, because I think a lot of my friends' stuff costs like $10,000 to $30,000, and I'm like, where did you get that money?
I just
especially don't know where to get all that. So I just have had to figure it out and pull things out of my ass because I don't have access to that kind
and
of money at all.
Work.
That was my whole feature, was $30,000.
But you still made it work.
I appreciate that though, because I think it's made me much more resourceful. If I had only me, if I had money to throw at stuff, I wouldn't be forced to think outside of the box, and I wouldn't be as good of a filmmaker because of it. That's how I would like to chalk it up to. Yeah.
I like it. Any last words before we head out of here? Any six words before we head out of here? Check out Christine Chen on Facebook, Instagram. You're not on Twitter.
Amazon. Go on. I am on Twitter. No. I just have
Go on Amazon and watch all of her movies. Are all your shorts there? No.
I have three that are in queue right now that are going to come out soon. So The Earth, that's already out. A Bird's Nest, Two Roads, and Not Your Ordinary Hero are coming out very soon on Amazon. Yeah.
Yes.
And Shakespeare I'm going to put out for free very, very soon at some point.
Nice. There's a whole reason for Shakespeare. That. Yeah. So. It's that's a fantastic short. I remember we talked about it last week. That's one of my favorite shorts. I love Shakespeare on the Range. Okay. Well, that's been Get Realism's podcast, you guys.
That's the Get Realism's podcast.
Get Realism's podcast. Go on getrealisms.com, pick up a book, up a poster, pick up a t-shirt.
Yeah,
pick up stuff.
Look at all these things we have. Now you can't. Nice. It looks like an ordinary black cup, but if you remember when I was sipping it, it said "Film is Life" on it. Yes.
They remembered it an hour and 10 minutes ago. So hopefully they see that.
Yeah, and the poster. Yes. So.
And the poster, getrealisms.com, getrealisms on Facebook, Moths to Flame Films on Facebook,
and we'll be here YouTube. Again. Next
we'll
week.
Be here. All right, guys.
Central
we are
time.
Signing out. We are stopping the recording for
peace out, mofos.
Facebook. Bye-bye.
Bye. And now we awkwardly stare as it tries to stop recording.
Yeah, no, it's done.
It's still recording, though.
Is it?
Yeah. I see the red button says recording.
Oh, no, it's recording to... It's just us recording. We're not live on.
Okay.
I'll edit all this shit out. I don't.
It's okay.
Who gives a fuck all this shit? Good. Great. Yeah.
Hey. Oh, good. That one went fast today.
You know, because we talked about some shit. We talked about writing. We talked about all sorts of shit.